From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Good Games Hobart and their new Endgame Cafe.
The Dice Men Cometh!
No, wait, no, stop. Stop the show.
What's wrong? No, the show?
I don't want to do an intro or anything this week. I'm not interested. Okay. I just want to tell you a really, really sad story.
Oh no.
Right?
Okay.
So I've been doing this workplace training, okay? Mm. And you know how you have those moments where you think maybe I don't entirely suck at what it is I do?
Never had those.
And I spent 5 days with these people, so you sort of start to get to know each other a little bit, and everyone's being really collegial and friendly, and then you let slip that you do a podcast, and they're really curious, and you're going, why did I open my big mouth? Yeah, and I said, no, look, it's I don't really want to talk about it. And they go, no, what is it, Ben? And I said, oh, it's really nerdy. No, but nerdy's... I said, oh, it's about board games and card games. What do you mean? And then it's like the next question is, so do you all dress up?
Yeah, and you said?
Like wizards!
And I got out my phone and I said, no, look, we've got sponsors and stuff. This is the podcast logo and everything. And she just cracked up completely. took one look at the name and just said, oh, I can imagine you all wearing cloaks and sort of lifting up your hood going, the Dice Men Cometh. And she was in absolute stitches, like just lost it completely and had to leave and like couldn't even look at me.
Well, that's fantastic.
For the rest of the entire training session. Wow. And I felt so embarrassed and awful.
You should be happy that you made someone laugh. That's our ultimate goal, isn't it?
Is it?
I don't know.
Let's see how we go tonight. Because this is another episode of the Dice Men Cometh. It's Radio 99.3 FM, and we're back with thanks to our wonderful, wonderful sponsor, Good Games and the Endgame Cafe. Game on!
Exactly. Now with comics.
Yes.
Garth, what's happening on the show tonight?
Well, tonight, which is the 30th of March, and it's episode 159, believe it or not.
Wow.
We are talking a series of games that we just found out are actually connected, Mark.
Yeah, it was amazing. We knew there was the Korean link there.
Yeah.
But we didn't know. Anyway,
we'll talk about that.
No spoilers.
So we will have a couple of what we've been playing. We will then throw to Trent, who will somehow tell us some news. That will fill up the hour. We will then go and play some games. I think we're playing Vast tonight, so that's going to be cool. But before we get to that, Trent's behind the desk.
Uh-oh.
He's got a song, and he's not afraid to play it.
Trent, Mark and Garth on The Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM, and Leon Bridges there with Better Man. And our show tonight sponsored once again by those damn fine people at Good Games and the Endgame Cafe. If you like eating, drinking in a well-ventilated space and maybe playing a game while you're doing all of the above,
mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, do it in.
Absolutely.
Mm.
All right, so we've been playing a game, chaps. A couple of times, actually. Got a couple of goes of this one in. Patch History. Now, of course, I have copped a fair bit of flack for having this one on my shelf for about, must be getting close to 3 years, I reckon.
Well, since it was called Patch Current, I think, really, wasn't it?
Oh, God. Came out in 2013. Designed
it's a very,
by.
Very timely review.
Yeah, yeah. Designed by Yoon Min Jung and Jun Hyuk Kim. With art by aforementioned Jun Hyuk Kim and Yanggon Lee.
Is it racist to have him try and pronounce this?
No,
because I was going to say, look, for those Korean listeners, Annyeonghaseyo, Gamsamnida, Mashi.
Wow.
Hang on, what's the last one I forgot? Mashiseyo. That means hello, thank you, delicious.
Yeah.
Props.
Because I did spend a couple of weeks in Korea, but there you go.
And where's the soju?
With the soju, definitely.
Would be fantastic, right?
So, as you guessed by the names, this is a game designed in Korea. We of course played the English edition because, although this one took a long time, playing the Korean edition would have taken a bit longer. But let's get to that later because I digress. So, produced by Danko Games, although there was an English production that came out the year later by Stunt Kite Publishing. It's a city-building, civilization game with economic elements, but then there's also negotiation and politics. And if you have played things like Through the Ages or Nations or Civilization, the board game of the computer game, then I think that you may really like this game. But it's got some really unique elements. Now,
real good twists.
Yeah.
That make it worth revisiting the thing.
Yeah, and it has a really different mix of mechanisms. So you've got action points, you've got an auction system and bidding, you've got sort of tile placement with a twist to the left.
You're not allowed to twist.
You've got votes, you've got worker placement. But the key part of this is, I guess it's sort of like tableau building, but you've got these, they're tiles, but they're on quite thin cardboard. And each tile is divided into quarters with different things on them, although some of them then get bigger and some of the pictures actually cover the whole four quarters. But these are representative of stuff that's happening in the civilization.
It almost looks like, once you put it all together, a sort of multicoloured chessboard with a bunch of different pictures on it.
Or, as the name says, like a patchwork quilt. Oh,
fantastic.
So your challenge is, you start off with one central tile, and then your challenge is each round. Now, let me get this right. There are three eras, or eras.
Yeah, there's more than three eras.
There's three eras. There's five rounds in an era, and there are 5 to 7 actions in each round. Oh, so there's a lot going on in this game. But the very first thing you are doing is you are bidding on tiles that you then patch into your tableau, and you have to cover over at least one of the bits that you've already got. And that's the first interesting decision is, I've got this tableau that's giving me a certain amount of politics points or resources or food or money or military, all these different resources that you have. And straight away, you're going to be covering over stuff. Now, there are empty spots of dirt called wastelands that you can cover, but soon you find out that you've actually got to cover over something good.
Yeah, I really do enjoy this part of the game because also with those wastelands which seemingly serve no purpose, you're able to recruit characters or heroes who will offer you benefits for the number of wastelands. So the last time I played, I would get some bonus military points for every 2 wasteland tiles I had. So you can't always just go and cover those up first of all.
Yeah, so multiple paths and strategies to take. Now, can I check, though, you say that you've got to patch over your existing tiles. You can't patch under?
You can patch under.
Oh, thank God. There's something else that I was doing.
Yeah. So you can patch under or over mostly.
Yeah.
But then there are also these seas, which are basically an empty water space that you can't do anything with, except there's also land reclamation. So one of your actions, you can basically turn the water into wasteland, and then later on you can do something on top of the wasteland. But the water really gives you some trouble sometimes because you can't cover over water, you can't go underwater. Again, it just becomes another interesting decision just in this very, very first part of the game.
Now, I'm really torn about the water because I like the idea of this, but I'm not too sure about how it relates with the wasteland as well, because the water is basically just a nuisance. That's all it is, because you can't patch over it, you can't patch under it, you can't patch two bits of water together. It really forces a lot of extra thinking in a game where the patching side of things is already quite complicated anyway. I'm sure we'll get to it down the track. Yeah. But I'm just going to park that thought in your heads there, Trent and Leon. Mark, God.
Nuisance, seas, land reclamation. Patch history is sounding fascinating so far, Mark. Please continue.
This is only the very, very first part of the turn where you're bidding for these tiles that you're then going to patch into your tableau. And the bidding as well, it's a... you said, Garth, it's got a system similar to Cyclades, is that right?
Yeah.
Where you basically, you always have to up your bid or at least match it on something else. You can't bid five and then all of a sudden you just go and get the one that's left over for one. So you have to be fairly considered in your bidding. And I found the bidding to be fascinating in this game.
Yeah, the bidding is really, really cool. I mean, the fact that you're going to always get a tile. You definitely 100% will get one of those tiles. So it comes down to which one do you really, really want? And then which one will you settle for when you don't get that one because someone else has got more money than you? And they just ruin your plans. Yeah. But it's great that you will be able to always get something. But money can be really, really scarce. So especially in the early stages or the early eras of this game, to be bidding $2 or $3 or $4, which is damn hard to come by, and not get the tile you want, can really impact your next era's worth of decisions.
Yeah, now we should say, so with these tiles, you've got various resource production capabilities, but you've also got heroes and wonders. So a classic example might be Julius Caesar, who gives you extra military for each, I think it was movement point you had, or politics point. And there are a whole range of different heroes, and there are wonders like from all over the world. So from chicken pizza in the Mayan temples.
Chichen Itza.
That's right. The Great Wall of China. You name it, it's in there as a wonder or a hero. I mean, those things have sort of special rule breakers or give you bonuses. But often, in fact, almost all of the time, they are more than one square. They are two, three, even sometimes four squares on a four square tile. So then when you get those, you've got to make a big decision about, I'm going to have to lose a fair bit of resource production to get this guy or girl out there. But some of them are really interesting. I mean, a classic example, you talked about Watergarth. Queen Elizabeth gave you extra something, so I can't remember, maybe politics point, for having workers on water spaces. But having workers on water spaces doesn't do anything else for you.
But there's only so much real estate that you've got to play with, because as you're patching together your civilization, you've got to stick within a certain size based on what era it is. They get gradually bigger as the game goes on. And so you're building up this marvelous little patchwork tableau as you play on.
And I mentioned workers. Did I mention this is also a worker placement game in a small way? Because you've got workers you have to feed every turn. Some tiles give you bonus stuff. If you have a worker on them, then you're also using your workers to move along these trade routes that you have between players, which give you resources. But the really interesting part is when you get to the end of a trade route, you then get a decision of, do I want to ally with the person at the other end of the trade route, or do I want to go to war with them? Now, allying gives you access to new trade routes, which are more produce more resources.
More lucrative,
They're more beneficial for both parties
involved.
Yeah,
that's right. And they become like a two-way trade route, whereas the other ones are only one way. But if you ally, then you can't go to war unless you spend a whole lot of action points, which are these politics points, to do that.
Yeah. Well, one could almost say it's like having a friendly route between friends.
You could almost say that, but Trent,
No one else was going to say it. Come on, it was there.
Yeah.
Come on.
You can't say trade route, though. That just doesn't work. Now, Trent, do you like having war with your neighbours?
Sometimes, occasionally.
Because did it work well for you when you decided to pull the trigger and go to war?
Not hugely, no. It seems that trade is generally more of a beneficial strategy unless you want to really double down on the military options in patch history and really go for broke, because it seems quite difficult to win those military.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned yet is that at the very, very start of this game, you will be given a couple of cards which are there to basically sort of give you an idea of a strategy you should pursue.
The prosperity cards.
Thank you very much, because they will then be used in some endgame scoring. Mm. Now, when it comes to the war side of things, you also need to absolutely obliterate your opponent for it to become a really lucrative deal. Is it 5 or 7 points you need to
exceed your opponent's defences by 5 things?
Yeah, so if you're the attacker, you've got a sword value, so your military strength, and when you're defending against someone who is taking you to war, you get to add your stones, your swords, plus your shields, So you automatically get the defender bonus,
yeah.
but then the attacker's also got to try and beat you by 5 points. It's, yeah. it's a really tricky
and
ask.
And you do get to throw your stones in for good measure to give you extra yeah. attack power. Oh. But look, and there's another couple of interesting actions that I loved in this game. So after you do the bidding and the patching, then you get into the rest of the action. So you've got political actions and you've got management actions. Now, I'm not going to go into a huge lot of detail, but among the political actions, you can aid someone. So you've got a certain amount of politics point you can spend, and each of these actions take a different amount of points. You can aid somewhere where you give them three things. If they take your three things, you get points. If they say, no, I don't want them, you still get some points, not just as many, which I think is really nice. And it sort of gets a bit like where you're seeing, what is it? Oh, Trent, I see you might be a bit short of money over there. I'm going to give you $3. If you take it, I get 5 victory points. If you don't take it, I still get 2 victory points. I find that an interesting decision. And then there's the threatening, which is another way you can use your military. So you threaten the other player. You just have to have more military than them. Nothing happens except they steal stuff off you, money or victory points.
And everything that you do, whether it be threatening or offering aid or any of the various sort of management actions where you're trying to set up those trade routes, they all cost the political points
yeah.
that are so hard to get. They're available from the tiles as you patch them in. You've got to activate them sometimes by trying to put workers on them. Political points are really hard to get, but it's how many goes you can actually have. And that diplomacy and management phase of each turn is really where the guts of the game is. Those are the important decisions. And the great thing about it is that it's largely simultaneous. You know, it's almost like a little bit of internal bookkeeping that you do in so many games, but you're not waiting for everybody to go, and make decisions. You can just do it all at once.
Yes. Yeah, that all sounds really good, but it's not a little bit of bookkeeping, Trent. It is several hours worth of bookkeeping because
everyone's got
their individual player board, yep. which tracks, is it eight different
yeah.
things?
Yeah.
And every time you patch something in or out, or you use one of the political actions, or you do something and you move a worker, you've constantly got to be referring to this little player board, and chances are you will make a mistake on it somewhere across the line because it's so fiddly.
Have we mentioned it's not a light game?
No.
Yeah.
No, but, well, the good thing is, on Board Game Geek, it says it only goes for 60 to 120 minutes.
I did want to point out that player board where you're keeping track of basically four resources and four things that you need to keep track of.
That aren't resources.
Look,
somehow.
It definitely, yeah. for people who've listened to last week's show, you know, you might have heard mentioned of slots. This is one game where slots would definitely be beneficial because one table bump and your little resource markers are going everywhere. But then again, you know, it is not an inelegant system for managing eight different things. Imagine if you had eight different resource tracks. That could be a huge pain. So as well as your political actions, you can build new trade routes. You can reclaim land. You can build new buildings on your wasteland. You can birth new workers. You can send them out on trade routes. And you can get bonus points by honouring your wonders and your heroes. There's so much to do. But as you mentioned, Trent, all these things take your politics points. And that's the action point driving thing in this game. And often we only had four or five politics points. And each of these things takes one or more. Now, did I mention the art in this game? Really, really like the art. Now, the art, one of the designers is also one of the artists, Junhyup Kim. I really love the art, particularly on the heroes. I don't know why. The pictures of those heroes and even the writing and the styling and everything, it just looks great. But the playtime.
Yes.
So on the box, on Board Game Geek, 60 to 120 minutes. Now, chaps, our first game with three players, that took more than 5 hours, okay? Our second game with four players, three of which had played it before, where we actually played a speed first era variant that we got from Board Game Geek, where basically you don't even play through the first era.
It is quite a slow start if you don't do this. So, yep.
That only took 4 hours.
And we didn't finish.
And we called it quits at the end of the second era. So, and it was funny because friend of the show, Carl, who we played this with twice, he was going to produce a spreadsheet to work out how, why it takes so long. Because yes, there's 3 eras. Yes, there's 5 rounds. Yes, there's 5 to 7 actions. But as you said, Trent, a lot of it is happening simultaneously. Where does the time go?
It goes into all of those 7 actions that you're doing. I mean, the thing is, if you're trying to condense this down to 2 hours, you've got 3 eras. So each era should take, is that 40 minutes? And yep. Then you've got 5 ages within each era.
Yeah, so that gives you 8 minutes.
That means
each.
You've got 8 minutes. And then you've got so many actions within that. It comes down to you probably all only being able to spend 2 minutes.
Yeah,
per
1 or 2 minutes. Yeah.
And it doesn't math at all. It doesn't make sense.
Nonetheless, I loved Patch History.
Oh, I had a ball with this.
I really, I don't know if we've done it justice tonight. Look, it is a little dry and certainly it's crunchy.
It's not dry. It is the story of civilization. You start with the basic sort of just getting food and a bit of military and trying to get some political points and you build up to these wonders. Oh, I
And the other thing is, if you compare it to, I mean, I played a 7-hour game of Nations and about 3 hours in, I started to pull out my hair and I hated the remaining 4 hours. I've played Through the Ages. I love that game, but it takes 4 or 5 hours. And if any of you ever played Civilization, that is 3 or 4
so
hours.
So 60 to 120 minutes. Bip-bow.
Per player.
Yeah.
Per player.
Patch History. Wonderful if you have the time. Would that be fair to say?
And look, and absolutely worth looking into with a regular group where you could speed it up. I couldn't recommend it more.
All right. That's what we've been playing lately, or trying to anyway. What are we doing next?
We're going to talk another Korean game.
Ooh, all right. That's next. That's Dice Man Cometh. It's Radio 99.3 FM.
That was Drowsy by Horse Thief on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh, Australia's leading board game podcast, proudly sponsored by the Endgame Cafe and Good Games Hobart. Did I mention they make pizzas? They've got beer, they've got cider, they've got comfy lounges playing, is it Xbox or PlayStation? I'm not a console man. pool tables, video games, pinball, what more could a gamer want? Oh, there's board games.
That's true. All right, so let's keep this Korean connection going because we've also been playing a game that is on the very other end of the spectrum to Patch History.
Just a bit.
However, it is by the same series of designers. What were their names again, Mark?
Yun Ming Jung and Jun Hip Kim.
You are so cruel.
Thank you very much. So we're talking Jeju Island by Grail Games. Now, this is, first of all, what is a Jeju Island? It is a little island which is on the southern tip of South Korea.
Yes.
So think of it as the Gold Coast for Korea, I guess. It's where a lot of local Koreans go
and
have their holidays.
Yeah, big honeymoon destination.
Very, very big.
And look, the amazing thing, and I learned this when I was in Korea, when Koreans go on honeymoon, they love to dress alike. And we're not just talking about the same T-shirt. They like to wear the same pajamas. They like to, or when I say the same, matching pajamas, matching swimsuits, matching everything. It's the big thing on Korean honeymoons.
Well, I think that's quite a sweet tradition. Here in Australia, we just wait until you're retired and then you just wear the same leisure suit on the Gold Coast.
Definitely. So, look, Jeju Island is a kid's game. Now, I'm just thinking back, I probably should have mentioned it last week when Trent was going through the finer details of Trouble and Slamwich. But Jeju Island is a very simple yet semi-strategic game using a very well-known mechanic called the Mancala mechanic. Now, Trent, you've not played this yet, but Mark, you played this a couple of weeks ago before we settled in for an epic time stories.
But we know the Mancala mechanic from Five Tribes most recently.
Yeah, Five Tribes, Trajan, Istanbul, and certainly a few other thinky, you know, harder, heavier games. But Mancala is a very simple, it's not pick up and deliver, it's pick up and move to the left or move to the right kind of mechanic. You've got, in Jeju Island, a very small board, maybe about, you know, double the size of, let's say, just two bits of A4 paper stuck together. You've got the map of Jeju Island, which is very cartoony, very cutesy art, and there's only 6 spots on this. Mm-hmm. So you don't have many spots to be able to go. There's only up to 4 players. You'll start with placing 6 of the black tokens, one on every spot, which are the neutral tokens.
Oh, those cursed black tokens.
I know. You will then go around, and each player will have 2 of their own little tiles. They'll put them on 2 separate stacks of those little tiles, And next to every spot, there is going to be a stack of about half a dozen different types of tiles that you will ultimately be trying to get during the course of the game. Because during the course of the game, you will be doing one of two things on your turn. You're either going to pick up a stack of all of the tiles in one spot.
Tokens. Don't get confused between tiles and tokens, because you've got a pile of tiles and you've got a poke of tokens.
A poke of tokens. Yes. All right, well, there you go. So you'll pick up your poker tokens, and then you will decide to move them to the left or to the right. You just got to keep going in the one direction. Yeah. And in the Mancala mechanic, you just drop the bottom one off on each spot, and around you go. Then every single player who has their colour at the top of each of the
token piles.
Thank you.
The token pokens.
They will get to choose the top tile from the tile stack that is next to the tokens.
Poken.
And you'll go around, everyone gets to do that. The second thing you will get to do on your action, if you decide not to pick up and go, is cash in some of those tiles. Mm. Because there will be five cards face up all the time during the course of the game, which you can cash in your tiles for, and they will give you victory points, or they might give you bonuses, such as a permanent type of tile, like a cactus or a mountain or a something tile, which is just that free plus one, which is great.
Cash in your tiles for better tiles. Can you cash in your tokens?
No, you can't, unfortunately. No, it's a real shame.
They've just got to stay in their
pokey token
spot. Your token pokens. No, so your tokens are just moving around the island all the time, whereas the tiles, you're burning through those piles of tiles. Yeah. And as you said, you're then trading in the tiles for cards. I have to mention the art. I love the little... I mean, yes, it's cutesy kitty art, but it's also, I don't know, it has a bit of a, like, a Tex-Mex feel. I mean, maybe it's because there's a cactus. I felt like it could be that sort of old school, I don't know, like an old school Mexican drawing, or I loved it anyway.
It looks like a table mat in a kid's Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I loved it. Like.
Yeah, so it's a very simple game, and it plays really, really quickly, because the game will stop as soon as all of the tiles on the board are gone, or you are unable to fill up to five cards again, because obviously every time you take one of the cards, you have to replace it. And it's a very simple game, plays in about 20 to 30 minutes, but it's beautiful, it's fun, and most importantly, the kids love it.
Garth, you didn't mention the
Harabang.
The Harabang statue.
Yeah, so you've also got this Harabang statue, which will basically be assigned to one of the tile stacks and one of the spots that your tokens will go at. Now, the way that works doesn't really matter. But whoever lands next to it, they get to choose either the tile on the top of the stack of tokens, or move the Harabang statue to something else and take the top of that one. That's all the rules there is
Look,
to it.
I got to tell you, though, this is one of those games that you can play with kids, and you can almost play full out in terms of not having to hold back on your strategic thinking. But, like, we played it with adults.
We also played it with Leon and Sarah, though. Hey! Sorry, Leon and Sarah, we love you.
You know, as adults, the strategy of, okay, which token do I get next? Which card do I get? Is it going to be more powerful to get five victory points, or will I get the permanent cactus so that I can sit on that for a while? I love the strategic element of that.
Yeah, and look, and the great thing is, unlike a lot of other games, a la Five Tribes and Istanbul, which can occasionally get bogged down in, I'm thinking about not just where I'm going to place my meeple, but the five other meeples I'm going to pick up, and what's the strategy they need to do, and blah, 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 and this one, all you got to really choose
which
direction
tile
do I go,
do I want?
And which token. Yeah. Exactly, because all of the tiles, they're only going to be used for a couple of the cards. You've got the divers, which are the wild, so it's good that they're thrown in there. But this plays simple, quick, and you can actually get it now. You went for a long time without being able to get it.
On the Grail Games shop?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, I wanted to mention the production quality on this. It is, the art is beautiful. The tiles are great and really, I was going to say fleshy, like they're nice and big and chunky. That's what I meant. And the cards, like I mentioned this to David from Grail Games, the cards were amazing. They have that sort of waxy feel, makes them really easy to shuffle, means they're going to last forever. I said, what did you do? And he said that they came from Korea that way. I have never seen cards like it in a game. I'm just fascinated by them.
I think that quality of card would have been fantastic in patch history. Patch history's card quality, as you said, needed to be thin so you could patch on and patch off, but you guys ended up using blue tack to be able to keep your little tableau together.
Hey, that's a fantastic little expansion to that
trademark,
game.
Trademark, patch history blue tack.
So, Jeju Island once again proving that there is nothing as vicious and sweary as a kid's game played by the Dice Men.
Oh, yeah.
Which is apparently Australia's number one board gaming podcast.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's what I should have said to her when she started laughing at me.
Should have told her that Rodney Smith from Watch It Played is now hooked on this podcast, as he told us the other day on Twitter.
Hi, Rodney. Well, I hope he likes us.
Maybe you should just wear your T-shirt all the time like Mark does.
Dice Man!
Everywhere. Have you ever washed that?
Yeah, I've got multiple.
Multiple food stains on it. Look at that.
Oh, that's just tonight.
All right, we're going to talk board gaming news. Next, Dice Man Cometh Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
This is Garth, and this is Trent, and this is Mark.
Hi.
How are we going?
Hey!
Guys, we've made it.
How?
Well, last week, you know how we talked about Smith's the Winterforge?
It was just
going out on Kickstarter.
Yeah, it was going to be awesome.
No, well, we don't need to talk about it anymore because it's already bloody funded.
What?
In less than 1 week.
No, Garth, in 24 hours it funded. Something like that.
Look, I know you're a stickler for the rules and for details and for an amazingly accurate timeline, but it doesn't matter. The point is, advertising works. Smith's The Winterforge, funded in somewhere between 24 hours and 7 days.
So Alan and Alistair and Dylan and everybody else who we don't really know at Ruler Mate Games in Bris Vegas.
And Table Tyrant Games.
They owe us a debt of gratitude for plugging Smith's The Winterforge.
Give us some gratitude, is that right?
Damn straight. Well, I think it's the Dice Man and our advertising single-handedly that's gotten this game across the line on Kickstarter.
Hang on, Trent. I will say, it is a big box Euro game produced right here in Australia. It's got some awesome artwork, graphic design by the amazing Ian O'Toole, and it's actually a bloody good game.
Look, that might have something to do with it,
Wait. But it's also got some runes.
The runes expansion has been funded in a stretch goal. Remember when we played it and we said that should be in every single game because it really takes it up a notch.
It made it gamey-wamey.
You know what I'm excited about now? The Raven expansion.
Ah, shut up about the Ravens, you bastards!
We're not doing this again.
Smiths of Winterforge, it's on Kickstarter now. Get on board because it's funded, it's going to be produced, and it's awesome.
Well, there you go. That was Foreign Architect with a song that just disappeared off the
That was called Poisonous Pill.
Poisonous Pill. Thank you very much. You are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3. And this week we are proudly sponsored by Good Games and Endgame Cafe. Basically, if you want a game and they don't have it, they will do everything they can to get it in for you. And I think that's pretty damn good.
Now, Trent, you can see why we're Australia's leading board game podcast now, can't you?
After
intros and outros like that.
So slick tonight. It's so great. Hey, look, I'm going, it must be time for board gaming news.
Woohoo!
If Castles of Mad King Ludwig was your thing, and that's a game that was a lot of people's thing.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Then it's going to get bigger with the upcoming Palaces of Mad King Ludwig.
Hang on. Isn't a castle a palace, or is it one of those all castles are palaces but not all palaces are castle type thing?
Every Mad King's home is his palace.
I don't know. It's the vibe, obviously.
Brand new game, new mechanics. This time, Ted Alsbach has everyone building one palace together.
Oh,
so you're not
right.
Building your other little separate ones. You don't have that auction mechanic. You're building one palace, but it's not a co-op.
Ooh.
It is competitive, and you're competing to have the most influence on the structure.
Ooh.
As you play, a moat is being built around the palace, and that is the timer to end the game when the moat gets complete. Plays 2 to 4, and its release is planned for October. Mm. Palaces of Mad King Ludwig. No doubt it'll be massive, just as castles. Although we haven't played that for a long time.
That's because we had the jump down, scratch out, punch fight between suburbia and castles.
Yeah.
And you two gents preferred suburbia, and I preferred castles.
For that Sin City vibe.
We've had that impasse ever since.
Well, it's also that you've not bought castles, so we can't play it. No, whereas Trent has suburbia.
That's right.
Hey, you know what two games I've always wanted to mix together? War of the Ring and Letters from Whitechapel. Not really.
But War now of the Ring, though?
Now it's happening. The brains behind War of the Ring, Francesco Nepotolo, let's see, now it's my turn, Nepotolo, and Marco Maggi, who made War of the Ring, and Gabrielle Mari from Letters from Whitechapel are getting together to make Hunt for the Ring.
Not Letters from a White Ring?
From Mary's Games. It's going to be out this winter, and it is the first part of the Tolkien saga where the hobbits are running around trying to hide from the Nazgul, so it's a hidden movement game set in the Tolkien universe.
That sounds really quite intriguing.
Hey, I've been watching the DC Legends of Tomorrow, and they've been doing time travelling with Rip Hunter and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they went into World War One, and J.R.R. Tolkien was a lieutenant in the trenches. Anyway, all this happens, and it, basically what they did inspired The Lord of the Rings. It was really clever how they wove it all together.
Although Tolkien always said that it wasn't a retelling of World War One.
I don't know.
Yeah, didn't
I
also say every man's home is his palace?
Or castle.
But does this mean that there will be two more of these games?
Yeah, quite probably.
So this is the first in a potential trilogy?
Yeah, well, you know, there's money to be made, those sweet, sweet Middle-earth dollars.
But how cool will it be if it continues on, like the results and the consequences from the first game lead into the second?
But the road goes ever on and on, Mr. Frodo.
Don't give people ideas, Garth.
That'd be the... Okay.
Oh, Mr. Frodo, what are
Hobby
you gonna do?
Hobby industry website ICV2 has
Not
taken...
Hobbit industry website.
Hobby industry website ICV2. I found out what ICV2 stands for.
Really?
It's Internal Correspondence version 2. Because Internal Correspondence was a hobby game magazine for years and years and years, and it went online, of course. So, look, fantastic website if you're at all interested in, the industry behind the games we play. They've taken their quarterly barometer of the hobby games industry once more, and it continues to be in excellent health, with 10% growth in the past year, the eighth year of growth in a row.
Wow.
Which is marvellous.
I'd like to say I've had about 10% growth this year with all the sitting at the table I've had lately. And
yeah, and I think I've had growth 8 years in a row, unfortunately.
Any country's economy would be happy to experience those kind of figures. Distributors, however, are apparently beginning to feel a little bit daunted about the sheer amount of product that they've got to get onto people's shelves.
But they should try and play that product.
Overall, the feeling is that we're growing and there's plenty of room for everybody. And it's certainly not a bubble. It's not a bubble.
Not even a pop-o-matic bubble?
That's bust. So the latest round of sales figures from ICV2 and from the industry from date from spring last year, so our spring. So let's go through some of the biggest selling games. The top five top-selling non-collectible card games. In reverse order, maybe?
Yeah.
Number five, Super Fight.
Okay.
We're all staring at each other blankly. No one knows it. Okay. Number four, Mark, you'll be happy, Arkham Horror.
Yes. No, okay. I sold it. but for a good reason and for good money.
Number three, Harry Potter and the Hogwarts Battle.
I knew that'd be in there.
Yeah. Codenames. Number
Which
number
one?
Two.
Wow.
I don't know.
I wonder if they're grouping them all together.
Underdark. Yeah, words.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Codenames Underdark. Is that the D&D version?
Oh, In the Dark or Through the Dark.
Number one selling non-collectible card game. Come on, guys. You can guess
Munchkin.
This.
Munchkin.
No.
Sushi Go.
No. Munchkin had dropped was only just in the top 10 this time.
Dice Masters?
Cards Against Humanity.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, still. So, you know, proving that just cheap, offensive jokes can make you a lot of money.
Yeah,
that's what we keep hoping for.
Give you a podcast that perhaps should have been put down a while ago. Okay, top five selling RPGs. I'll do these in order from first to last. D&D 5th Edition.
Yep. Wow. Back to the top of the charts.
Of course, the number. And just reinforcing what a stellar idea that Wizards have, stellar job that they've done.
Yeah, and continuing to bring out stuff really, really regularly, which is great.
Pathfinder at number two. Mm. There's still life in the property. We were concerned that it might have been maybe falling out of favour, but no.
But Mark, you're keeping on buying the stuff. Good on you.
Star Wars, the role-playing game, continues to do very, very well. All three versions of that now, the Force and Destiny books are out there.
I so wanted to like that one. I so really wanted to, but the dice, although they are such a cool system to roll so many dice, just trying to figure out whether... hell, you've succeeded or failed.
Well, now with Imperial Assault, why... I mean, yeah, I know it's not as freeform as a role-playing game, but, you know, you've got the structure there. You've got the minis. You've got the campaign.
Yeah. We gave it a red-hot go.
We did. We tried hard to like it.
That system, but, interpreting the dice was a problem.
Mm.
Surely there's an app for that. Number four, this was odd, Shadowrun. Yeah. Is the fourth biggest seller, and there hasn't been a new version of Shadowrun in quite some years, so I don't know what's going on there, but suddenly proving popular again. And at number five, Call of Cthulhu, the seventh edition, and dare I say the most streamlined version of the rules as well, which we've been having some fun with, and we might talk about that in another episode. Okay, top 10 selling board games from 2016, or at least the spring quarter. We'll go in reverse order. Number 10, Carcassonne. Number 9, Ticket to Ride. No surprises there. They're always hanging around. Number 8, Imperial Assault.
Ooh, excellent.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, yep, those sweet, sweet Star Wars dollars.
And that's without the app, which surely will be around sooner or later.
Number 7, Jim Henson's Labyrinth.
Really?
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay, now that's got to be the property.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because it's apparently not a great game.
Yeah.
It does look fantastic, though.
It does.
And if there's any film from your childhood that's going to lend itself to being a board game, it's going to be that, yeah.
Well, and, of course, the timing of the release of that and the unfortunate loss of David Bowie, it's all sort of come together.
Oh, yeah, wow. Oh, actually, this was just before he died.
Well, maybe he planned it that way.
Whoa, now we're seeing the true power of Bowie. Number 6, Mansions of Madness.
Ooh,
not surprising. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Ooh, bloody expensive, though. Number 5, Speak Out. Number 4, Catan.
Mm-hmm.
Hey?
Yeah. It never goes away, does it?
Never goes away. Number 3, this surprised me, Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Really?
Wow.
I guess they
did the re-release, then they also released the Widow's Walk expansion as well. So I guess
first expansion that they've ever had.
I wonder if they're grouping the two together.
Was it featured on tabletop recently, or am I... Or is that a while ago, maybe?
No, I think it was a while ago.
Okay.
But, you know, there is certainly no denying there is a tabletop effect, or is there with the new sort of behind-the-paywall model.
Second most popular game from the spring quarter, Scythe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huge.
As it should be, Mark. It is a great game.
Okay. Let's not go back there. Lots
of slots in that one, too.
So everybody keeps telling me. And number one, Pandemic.
Yeah.
Not sure which version.
No.
If they're talking about Iberia
I reckon
or Season 1
them
or
all
Legacy.
Together.
Or, yeah, I reckon so. And
well, now you've got Cthulhu, you've got Iberia, you've got Legacy, Season 1.
Season 2
coming,
is on the way.
The base game.
Anyway, look, one more quick bit of news and then we'll just take a quick break. Speaking of Scythe... Scythe's Jamie Stegmaier has announced his follow-up. It's almost ready to go. Charterstone from Stonemaier Games. Are you across this?
I was expecting it to be called Plough,
not Ho.
This is a village-building legacy game.
Ooh.
And the artwork's got a very sort of kiddie-friendly, it's almost like a Studio Ghibli look to the art little airships and stuff. It was announced originally early last year. It's now going to be published in the second half of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting people quite excited. Players are building the village of Green Gully with stickers becoming dice placement areas. Yeah. So it's a worker/dice placement game with a branching storyline. And we're being promised that play decisions early on will affect the outcome permanently.
So legacy style.
Legacy style.
Mm.
Now, here's the big selling point. There is no rule book. No rule book. Or rather, you build the rule book as you go.
Right.
You play over the course of just 12 games, during which you progressively open 75 crates.
Oh, wow.
that are going to be inside this box at last count. Now, that might change. I mean, because it's still being tweaked.
Yes.
So you just progressively open those, pull the stickers out, stick them onto the board and into the rule book. And at the end of all of this, you will have your own unique version of this worker placement game that you can then go on to continue to play. Charterstone. There's not a lot of images or anything available, but, gee, it sounds intriguing.
And the art looks super sweet.
It does. But what I do like about it, and you just mentioned it briefly there, is the fact that it doesn't have that end game. It doesn't have the you've played 12 games and it's over. Jamie Stegmaier has quite openly said, once you get to the end of the legacy or the actual campaign, I guess, it is just your unique game that you can then continue to play again and again and again. So it doesn't, unlike Legacy, Pandemic Legacy, it doesn't just stop. And that's, again, maybe an interesting way to go. And you could see people possibly having multiple versions of this game and playing it in a couple of different ways.
Well, look, if it's up to the usual Stonemaier quality, with just the sort of glimpses we've seen, this is going to look, feel and play amazing. This could blow the roof off.
And it is not going to Kickstarter.
Oh, really?
Right.
That's why.
Wow.
Hey, I've actually got... can I talk a little bit about Kickstarter? Shall we just plough through now and do the rest of the news, or shall we play a song and come back? Let's just plough through.
Let's go.
Let's just plough through. All right.
You're on a roll.
So, Brotherwise Games, who gave us Boss Monster.
Yes.
Massive hit, and all of its expansions. They've got a new product coming called Unearth. It's another dice placement game. You're rolling big fistfuls of dice to reclaim lost ruins and rebuild your civilization, blah, 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 blah. The art is reminiscent of the iPad game Monument Valley. You guys remember that? The sort of 3D isometric thing where it was almost like an Escher puzzle that you were walking around and twisting and turning it around. It looks sweet. It really does. 2 to 4 players, heaps of dice and cards, and Brotherwise has a big retail support program to go with this game. Why am I mentioning this?
Good question.
Because they're not putting it on Kickstarter.
Yeah, hey.
They're actually just going to be releasing it as normal and supporting it through bricks and mortar stores.
Excellent.
Which is, a lot more than what... Well, even a frequent offender like Come On, Cool Meanie or Not, they're trying to shift to backing their retailers as well. They're actually launching a new support program for North American stores, which is good to see. So, look, that won't be coming to Australia anytime soon, but it does mean that there's going to be little bonus bits of swag and promos and stuff that are around for
your Cool Mini or Not
games.
The Kickstarter pendulum is maybe starting to swing back the other way.
Or maybe not, because we've all heard about, kickstarting your various games or films or whatever.
Yeah.
But actually, Garth, you brought this to my attention. This is a brand new one. Kickstarting or crowdfunding to raise equity in your company by selling stock?
Yeah, basically. So this is something that Tasty Minstrel Games, who are a great friend of the show and have been very generous in their support of us in providing games, they very recently, in fact, in the last, the last month or so, through a little program called Microventures, have released the ability to become a shareholder and invest within the Tasty Minstrel Games for their future product, their future profit, hopefully, their future growth and expansion. They've so far raised just under $63,000. They were going for a minimum of 50, anywhere up to $1 million. Mm-hmm. And you can back from anywhere from around $150 up to $25,000 in this company. Now, it was just something that, I mentioned to Trent because I had not seen it before. You see companies and podcasts and reviewers go on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or any of those crowdfunding platforms. Yeah. But seeing a business go and explicitly say, we want you to invest in our business, and as that, you will become a shareholder with a certain amount of power, opinion, and obviously risk, it was just something that I hadn't seen before, and I thought that's an interesting sort of switch for a business model.
But then on the other hand, I mean, how is it really different to a regular stock offer? It's just the platform that you're choosing to put it out on, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. I think it's
and you may as well go where people who are interested in buying your stock are.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And they're crowdfunding. They're on those sites.
And that's completely fair enough. I'll be very curious to see what the final number ends up on, because it's got another month to go. Traditionally, these things, they start big and they finish big and they have a little bit of a lull in the middle, but interesting idea for sure.
Do they have stretch goals?
The more money you pay, the more stuff you will get.
Oh.
So,
okay, a few more bits of news and then we'll get out of here. Upper Deck is now taking orders for a 2-to-5-player game lasting 30 minutes in which players are running competing ranches overrun with wild animals, including elephants, lions, and dingoes.
Hey.
Crikey.
That raises some questions right there, that mix of animals. Anyway... Upper Deck are calling this game The Dingo Ate the Baby.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
They're not.
They are.
Oh, no.
It's a kid's game.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding.
A dingo ate my baby.
It's in extremely poor taste.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on, it's April 1 in a couple of days' time. They haven't got in early,
reals.
Have they?
It's for reals.
Yeah, okay.
IDW Games has announced a partnership with... Atari.
Oh, wow.
Atari still exists.
Really?
That's the big take-home message out of this. IDW Games is going to bring old video games to the tabletop.
Okay.
Okay, the first three titles have been announced. Centipede, Asteroids, and Missile Command.
Oh, wow.
The board games, and all of them are being designed by John Gilmore.
No.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yep, from Dead of Winter.
How does he have time on his hands to design another million games?
Well, I mean, what do you really have to design with Centipede? I mean, half the work's done for you, I suppose. Anyway, look, some of these old games have also been licensed for films too. So, you know, that'll work.
Yes.
It's a clear sign that IDW knows its market. look, one final bit of news, just to prove that I know absolutely nothing about the board gaming hobby. Stronghold Games has announced the latest installment in its Great Designer series with a new one from Uwe Rosenberg. Rosenberg?
Rosenberg.
It's called Cottage Garden.
Yeah.
In so which cute. You...
farm flowers?
Grow a cottage garden. Make 5 trips to the market to buy supplies for your cottage garden and compete to make the best garden bed. I know nothing, clearly. And that's the news.
There you go. Thanks, Trent. Now, that pretty much takes us to the end of the show. Obviously, thank you very much for listening. If you want to get all the hot news that is fit to print, you should definitely check us out on Facebook.
Instagram.
Check us out on Instagram.
Just hit 1,300 followers.
Well, it's 13, then 12.99, and then back up again.
Yeah, so. Who was that?
Oh, yeah, we don't like that person anymore. But obviously we have dicemencometh.com. We have the Instagrams. We have the Twitters. We're on all the forms of social medias.
And we've got to thank our sponsor again, Good Games and the Endgame Cafe. Thanks for helping us out, guys. And if you're in Hobart, if you're making a trip, there's more than just Mona here as well, okay? There's the Endgame Cafe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, we better go. We got to cram for the quiz night that's happening on Saturday night.
Oh, and very quickly, don't forget to back an Aussie Kickstarter that's on asking for your bucks right now. Smiths of Winterforge. Get in there and check it out.
Does it have any raisins?
Shut up.
Or Ravens?
Edge Radio 99.3 FM. We'll see you next week.
Bye!
But seriously, though, you should check out Jeju Island. It is actually really fun and actually rather simple, despite the explanation of my colleagues going on about their tiles and tokens and stacks. Twats.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Good Games Hobart and their new Endgame Cafe. Find us on dicemencometh.com, Facebook, Instagram, and if you like what you hear, please support us on Patreon.